Hello and welcome to TDF Talks. I'm Lucy Fagans, and this is a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. In this podcast, we chat to leading Australian creatives of all kinds. This is episode 40, and it's the final episode for 2019. Thank you to everyone who has tuned in this year. We'll be back in 2020, and we would love to receive your feedback and any ideas on who you want to hear from when we return. So you can email me on lucy@thedesignfiles.net with any insights or ideas that you would like to share. I was more than a little starstruck to speak with best-selling author, food stylist, magazine editor, and media personality Donna Hay earlier this month. Donna Hay is, of course, a household name, both here and overseas, having edited her self-titled magazine for 17 years, reaching subscribers in 82 countries around the world. Over the past 20 years, she's also authored 27 best-selling cookbooks, selling over 6 million copies worldwide, and has hosted TV series screened in over 17 countries. Whilst I only met Donna in person just recently for this podcast, she has always been incredibly supportive of The Design Files, and I've really valued that. Way back in 2011, a mere 3 years into launching this very humble and basic blog at the time, I had the naive confidence to email and ask Donna for an interview, and to my delight, she agreed. That was almost 9 years ago, and for me, it was a defining moment. To think that an editor as esteemed as Donna Hay would agree to an interview with me really felt like a seal of approval, and it was a sign I felt that I was onto something. And so earlier this month, when I flew up to Sydney for the first time to meet Donna in person, it really did feel a little bit like coming full circle. Donna wasn't quite what I expected. I think I imagined that she would be some sort of very loud, decisive, powerhouse sort of character. In fact, she wasn't at all like that. She was actually quite softly spoken, and she seemed really reflective and curious and thoughtful. I learned that Donna actually isn't a big goal setter, nor much of a forward planner, which really surprised me. And I also learned that even Donna suffers at times from fear of failure. So there's definitely hope for the rest of us. It was such a pleasure to chat with Donna about the incredible rise of her brand over the past 20 years and how it felt to close her magazine last year after 100 issues and 17 hugely successful years. We discuss the wellness industry, the future of food, and so much more in this conversation, and we really hope you enjoy listening in. Hello and welcome to TDF Talks. Today, I'm very excited to be in Darlinghurst in Sydney at the headquarters of magazine editor, author, food stylist, and media personality, Donna Hay. And I'm thrilled to be speaking with the woman herself. Donna, thanks so much for being on our podcast.
Oh, you're welcome, Lucy.
So exciting to be in your space. And as we mentioned before, we're right in the thick of Donna's headquarters. There's cooking going on. There's a little bit of background noise, but we hope you'll forgive us. It's a very busy and creative space.
It is indeed.
Donna, I can't even succinctly capture everything that you've done, and obviously we can't cover everything today, but before we get into your many achievements, I'm wondering what you were doing before all this. If you could just give us a sort of brief overview of your career background, I guess, before you launched Donna Hay magazine in the early 2000s.
Wow, that's a long time ago.
I know, cast your mind back.
Well, I was too scared to study to become a chef because I had parents who didn't raise their voice at me. I had really chilled out, calm parents. So the thought of me going into that type of environment, and we're talking a long time ago, I just knew I wouldn't last.
Yeah. In a commercial kitchen sort of world.
Absolutely. Yeah. With raised voice, you know, and that kind of pressure and tension. And when you have parents that don't raise their voice, it's pretty unusual. So I was pretty quiet and shy as well. So I did this funny course, home economics course, and really I just went to do it because I thought I'd do a couple of weeks and then drop out and spend the summer on the beach.
Yeah.
Naughty me.
That didn't happen.
It didn't happen. I met some really fun girls from the country who were boarding school girls. And if you know about boarding school girls from the country, they're really good at getting into trouble.
Okay.
But never, the trouble never sticking to them.
Yeah.
So I had a really great time at this course, and it was a really fantastic course. They don't have it anymore, but it was all of the basics of cooking, all of the science, how to write a recipe, nutrition, like just everything that I really needed to set myself up for my career. It was amazing.
Wow.
And it was at the same college as East Sydney Fashion Institute in the old jail.
Oh, wow.
I mean, just up the road here in Darlinghurst, actually, now that I think of it. So I did like this funny home ec course.
Yeah.
And then I decided that I better be really, really dedicated, because there was no jobs. There was hardly any freelance work.
Yeah.
There was definitely no full-time jobs. So I thought, well, if I become the best food stylist assistant and then the best recipe writer that's on time, never runs a deadline, I've just got to be the best, because I've got to get as many bookings as I can. Otherwise, I can't pay my rent. I'm going to starve, and I'm going to have to get a new job that I don't love.
Yeah.
And I think even at that young age, knowing that your hobby could be your career is just so powerful and so motivating.
Totally.
So I just worked my butt off, really.
Yeah. It feels like it was very clear from the very start that that was what you wanted to do, and you knew, you sort of had a vision for where you wanted to head, which isn't always the case. I think sometimes it's a more meandering path, but like, did you just feel like food was always going to be your thing?
I just wanted to, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just wanted to have my hands in food. And even when I was a little girl, my dad had built us a cubby house. I'm one of three girls, yep, the youngest. My dad had built us a cubby house in the backyard. And I just remember how often I played mud pies and make believe with a tea set and cooking with my sisters. And we had a little set of pots and things. So when my mom let me cook in the kitchen from a really young age, it was just like the best thing ever.
Yeah.
I was no longer mixing water from the tap with sand and mud. I was in there,
yeah,
for real.
Yeah.
And it was exciting and it was amazing. And it's so rewarding, cooking. You know, you mix things together. There's a scientific phenomena that happens, and then you get this wonderful product at the end that you get to share with people.
I know. It feels like a magic trick, really, when you cook a beautiful
recipe. Yeah, when you're a little kid, it is.
Yeah.
It's all magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then fast forward a little bit to when you launched the magazine. So in 2001, you launched Donna Hay, and, you know, that, just to completely understate it, like, it was such an iconic title. It defined an era of cookbooks and food publishing that came after that. And I wonder what your initial goals were when you had the vision for that magazine and what you wanted it to be. And did you ever think it would become the huge success that it became?
No, I didn't. I've just always focused on content. And I think that's where I was really lucky. Just before that, just to rewind a second, because I think the most powerful thing in my career is when I started just being a freelance food editor on Marie Claire.
Yes.
New launch. And then I had the opportunity to do a book, which was only called Marie Claire in Australia because of licensing rights. And then it was called My Name everywhere else in the world. And that was the real springboard of my career, is that white on white kind of styling that I did for a couple of reasons. The produce here is amazing. My friends didn't know how to cook. They needed to see how the onion was chopped, how the chili was chopped. Was so tired of taking their phone calls.
You probably still get some of those phone calls.
I do. I'm not so tired of them anymore. But, you know, I never imagined that kind of global springboard that opportunity gave me, that new styling of white on white. I just, even now, people still talk about it,
yeah,
just having been overseas. That, and I kind of just feel so fortunate that I was given that freedom to be my creative self.
Yeah. So the Marie Claire was where you sort of, your style, I guess, started to emerge and started, yeah, to be known. And then when and how did you come up with the plan to launch your own magazine?
Well, I was working not just on Marie Claire, I was working on Marie Claire Lifestyle, which was a title back then. I think they've just revived it as a one-shot. But I was working closely with Sabella Court, who was one of my really good friends, still, yes, is, but we worked together a lot back then. And we had like about 30 pages in Marie Claire Lifestyle to fill. Some I did with Sabella as a food lifestyle shoots, which were amazing. And I remember the exact time when I realized I was getting out.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Sabella and I had dragged a block print tent from Rajasthan into the sand dunes, a 3-seater couch, a wooden one, all this other props, all the food, a model, clothes, the whole thing, into the middle of the sand dunes, done this beautiful shoot, really beautiful. Sabella is very, very clever.
Yes.
She's a true creative in every sense of the word, and you don't meet many of them. And then when I saw the story and what it had been laid out to be, I just cried and I gave up.
Really?
Yeah.
And it just didn't fulfill your vision.
No.
Yeah.
No. I just didn't. So I gave up styling altogether for a little while.
Wow.
So I sat in my studio and I was a bit grumpy.
Yeah.
It was a bit, I was in the middle of a huge tantrum.
Yeah.
Well, toys had really gone out of the cot. So I started just on a blank wall in my studio. I was just doing some advertising work to pay the bills and things like that. But and I was working a lot overseas. Australian food photographers and stylists really had their pick of so many jobs overseas. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
And that was just an incredible time in my career as well. But on the wall, I started to, such a petulant, if I think back about how arrogant I was.
No.
Started to put on the wall what it would be like if I had a magazine,
yeah,
not being at the hands of an art director that would just get your film and lay it out and they're showing my age film. So I just started to map out what it would look like if I had a foodie lifestyle magazine, and Sydney being the small town it is, word got around. And, two mag houses came knocking, and the rest is 17 years of many, many deadlines and lots of hard work.
Unbelievable. So, yeah, that's so interesting that I guess it was born a bit out of frustration that you had a vision that was sort of maybe had been a bit diluted and you really wanted to, do it your way, I guess.
Yeah, I think some of those frustrations I then took as learnings to how I would set up the magazine. So I never had the art department far away from discussions about what the shoot would be or what the food would be. You know, everybody saw the food, ate the food, shared the food, looked at the props. Like everyone was no surprise. The images didn't come across your desk if you were going to lay that out and you'd be seeing it for the first time. You were kind of in on the story, on the daydream, on the vision.
Yeah, that's so important.
On the storytelling.
Yeah.
And I think that was the most important thing that we started is that we're all in together.
Yeah, the shared vision. That definitely comes across now that you say it. And I guess in a big magazine house, it is harder to do that because a lot of resources are shared and, not everyone is necessarily on your team.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was just a freelancer. So I did just turn up with my story idea. And then the next time they saw me, I had my film in my hand.
Yeah.
So there was a huge disconnect.
Yeah. And so, I mean, one really notable thing about the magazine and your brand more broadly is the incredible success you've had, not just here, but overseas, because, it's really rare for an Australian title or any Australian brand really to have massive international success. It doesn't happen that often. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about what you think, where that came from, like what was the key to really getting international markets interested in what you were doing?
Oh, I think the books played a really big part in it and the style of the books. It was really fresh and new.
Yeah.
And then I think as foodies, we're really lucky here. We have amazing produce, really amazing produce, and it's abundant. When you buy a bunch of basil, you get a great bunch of basil.
Yeah.
It's not in plastic, a little clipped up plastic container. It's a real bunch. So I think that really gives foodies here the edge. The other thing is that we don't have rules, which suits me absolutely down to the ground. So we don't have to follow French traditional cooking rules or the way the English cook, or, we don't have that traditional kind of hard and fast, this is how you do it. We've always had flexibility, and then we had a great influx of people from all over the world come and influence our food culture. And, I remember only being able to buy coriander in a small shop in Chinatown back in the day, but now it's mainstream. And, the flavors just kept opening up more and more and more. And it wasn't just meat and three veg anymore. It was lemongrass and ginger and galangal and things that I just, was just kept stumbling across all these new ingredients.
Yeah.
And so because we don't have the rules, I think Australian chefs and Australian foodies got really good at combining them, not in a fusion way, just for the flavor that it is.
Yeah.
Galangal is ginger with a bit lemony, and how do we use that? Not kind of falling back on tradition.
Yeah. That's
we
so
kind of use an ingredient for what it is and what it can add to a dish.
Yeah.
So, I think that was a real strength and why there's so many Australian chefs doing so well overseas. And it's just a different point of view, I guess.
Yeah, that's funny you say that. I feel like maybe that's true of a lot of Australian creatives because, Australian design and architecture also has a sort of freedom about it that isn't always the case in, say, European cities. And maybe it's the same thing. It's like we're not steeped in such years of history. So we do
history and rules and
have some freedom there. Yeah, that's such an interesting viewpoint. So now I know this is a long time ago now and it's a bit of a segue, but I have to ask because the girls in my office, yesterday I was in my office and I said, guys, I'm meeting Donna Hay tomorrow. If you have any questions for her, let me know. So this is one from Chelsea. Shout out to you, Chelsea. She wanted me to ask you, in December 2011, you were appointed by Tourism Australia as the creative director of Oprah Winfrey's Welcome to Sydney Party when she and her audience members came out to Sydney and shot that iconic episode out on the Sydney Opera House steps. I would love to hear a little more about that experience. So what did that entail? Do you recall what you created and how that came about?
Yes, I'll never forget that. Well, talk about stretching outside your comfort zone, but just going for it. I worked with lots of people. So an events production company, caterers, so many different people. And I did so many things that I was doing for the first time and that I know I will never do again.
Yeah.
Like choreographing fireworks.
So it's bigger than food. It was the whole.
It was the whole lot. And the reason why I signed up to do it and I only was given 6 weeks to pull it together.
I can't even get my head around that.
I know. It was really. Is that I love where I live. I've traveled overseas a lot. I spent the early parts of my career not really, you know, traveling backwards and forwards, but I really love living in Australia. I think we're so lucky. I think it's a great city, Sydney. So I wanted to show all the great things about it. So I cut the party into three, the really cosmopolitan city that we have. So I had a modern part, the country, which is 45 minutes away, Gum Leaves, R.M. Williams. They opened up their archives to me. People were so generous. It was just an amazing experience.
Yeah.
And then I shipped in tons and tons and tons of sand and made a little Bondi Beach as well where Messina was and Pete Evans was cooking lime and lemongrass prawns on a barbecue and it was just super fun.
Yeah.
And it was great to see the whole vision come together, but it was pretty funny at the time when people said to me, you know, oh, at 3 o'clock you have to be at the meeting with the fireworks guy. You have to choreograph the fireworks and me just winging it. So I just, in her Oprah's rider and her color palette and things that I got from her team, I knew what colors she didn't like. So I just took them out of the fireworks and just went from there. I just winged the whole thing and tried to do my best.
That's amazing. That's a good lesson in just biting off more than you can chew and just, winging it.
Yeah, just put your head down
and it went off
and go for it.
Except for that moment where, what happened? Hugh Jackman.
Oh, no, that wasn't on my party. That was the next day, thank goodness.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. He nearly killed himself, but, you know, that's a small detail.
Okay, enough about Oprah. We're here to talk about you. So last year, Donna Hay Magazine wrapped up with its 100th issue after 17 years. After so many years invested in that magazine, how did it feel to close that chapter?
I had been thinking about it for a little while. The number 100 is a very rounded final number. It's really mixed emotions for me, but what I did know is that I needed to get back to what I love and what I love doing and why I started all of this, why I put so much effort and time into my brand and who I am. And I just kind of felt like I was getting too old to sit at a desk.
Oh, no, not too old, but maybe just too wise.
Too old. So, you know, 17 years is a long time for anyone to stay in one job.
Yeah.
And when I started, I was, you know, styling and creating and making little craft projects and making my own felt vessels to be in a shoot and really hands-on. And as it moved along, I was still part of the creative vision and very much part of the production, but then I had to hand over all the shoots. If I tried to do a shoot, I'd get really behind in budgets and paperwork and all that other stuff and driving the magazine. So I just, you know, there was nothing, the magazine was really healthy and subs and sales and everything else, but it just felt like the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just wasn't, I was kind of done. I felt like the driver of a runaway train.
Yeah.
There's no brakes.
Yeah.
You just go past station. The stations felt like deadlines. You just pass them.
Yeah. And straight on to the next.
Straight on to the next station.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I grabbed the brake.
Yeah.
And put it on.
Yeah. Good on you. I guess in a way it feels like what you're saying is you wanted to sort of reclaim that early passion and the creative part of what you do and sort of choose to do that again.
Maybe. Yeah, I really missed it. I really, really missed it.
Yeah.
And I guess I just was sitting in my office one day thinking, I just don't know if this is not my dream job anymore.
Yeah.
It was, but what happened? I just don't know what happened. 17 years went past.
Yeah. It's such an inspiring thing, though, I think, to close something that is doing well and, you know, to do it for those right reasons rather than sort of, you know, things often just peter out. And I think it was a strong way to end it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
I always wanted to go out on a high. So. Yeah.
Oh, you definitely did. And so what does your business look like today? So we're sitting in your beautiful space and obviously you've still got your books and many other things on the go, but tell us a bit about, I guess, who's in your team and what Donna Hay Inc. is today.
My team is very small. It's very flexible. I have a great team of freelancers. I have a team of three.
Okay.
At the moment in the office, which is great. I love small, nimble team. And I guess the good thing about shutting the magazine and starting the new Donna Hay Inc. is that opportunities are vast, you know, like the things that have dropped through the door have been amazing and I have time to do them now.
Yeah.
So I'm not just doing food. I'm doing more creative things as well.
Yeah.
Which takes me back to, you know, crafting my felt pieces and making leather pieces with Sabella Court and
yeah.
all the fun things we used to do. I guess it's just a really lovely freedom that we have at the moment.
Yeah.
And that is priceless.
Yeah.
Yes.
Totally. I guess, yeah, it feels like you're almost back in startup mode in a way. I mean, with.
No, we are. Totally.
Yeah. That's fun. There's something really.
I remind myself of that as I put the bins out.
yeah.
And then we just got to do things like, you know, put a lot of energy into the big festival at Bondi, which we finished a couple of weeks ago in. Just have a bit more fun.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have a 6-week deadline looming over us, so we just get to be a bit more flexible and nimble and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Now that you're free of that dreaded bi-monthly deadline, yeah, you've been obviously doing more books and I wanted to ask you specifically about the wellness festival that you just hosted. So where did that idea come from and how did it go?
Well, I had the idea back in January earlier in the year that I wanted to have a festival that we could reconnect with all of the magazine readers and the book buyers and everyone else that makes the Donna Hay recipe and really get out and have a festival that they could join in.
Yeah.
So we've done some things that were like a lunch to launch a book and things like that, but I wanted to have it over multiple days so lots of people could come. We have lots of interstate visitors as well as some visitors from New Zealand and further afield than that, which is amazing. So we planned to have it over the 3 days, so the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we took over the iconic Bondi Pavilion, which is pretty crumbly and old and needed a lot of Donna Hay sprinkle magic.
Yeah.
So we built to covered a lot of things and
there
was a lot of tongue and groove covering.
Yeah, I saw the photos. It looked absolutely flawless. Yeah.
It was great. And I wanted it to be lots of things. So I wanted the daytime festival kicked off with Pilates and a green juice and some lovely goodies from PE Nation. And then we had a green smoothie station. You could bottle your own limited edition Cobram Estate Donna Hay olive oil for free on the day. There was free organic coffee.
Amazing.
So there was lots of things to do. You could come to a bliss ball workshop with me where everyone cooked along at the same time as I did, which we'd never done before.
Wow.
So that was hilarious.
Yeah.
It was good fun. And then we just had straight cooking demos as well that I was doing.
Yeah.
We had like my favorite organic producers that are third generation. They're selling organic produce and my
amazing.
Yeah. So it was just a little bit of everything for just people to come and experience what we've been up to and to kind of feel well.
Yeah.
And sit on the deck at the pavilion there in the sun and
amazing.
And then in the afternoons we shut for an hour and redressed the space and we had a well chilled festival with Cloudy Bay.
Ah.
Which is all I think part of being well is that, you know, I can send text messages and things to my girlfriends, but connecting with them and having some time to spend with them with some food and some lovely wine, I think is the real thing about wellness.
Yeah.
And why Cloudy Bay wanted to come on to do the Well Chill Festival with us, because, you know, there's nothing can replace that human contact with your friends, your girlfriends, your boyfriends, everybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we made it really low key.
Yeah.
I made some really yummy recipes to go with their wines and we had generous amounts of Cloudy Bay wine and sat in the sun and on the deck and made sure that people brought their friends and had a good time.
Sounds so lovely. It really sounds like a lovely thing to do in your first year as well of the new phase of your business to sort of reconnect with your audience in that way. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really good. It was great. I mean, we learned a lot. We kind of, you know, as I usually do, jump in the deep end and let's, like, the, you know, nothing's changed since the Oprah party.
Yeah.
Let's just jump in and see how we go.
A few less fireworks this time around.
Damn it. That's new. There was something missing.
No, I don't know if that would have been quite right. Yeah, I just wanted to ask you briefly about wellness. I mean, as a sort of, I sort of hate the idea of trends, but it is a trend and it's showing no signs of slowing down. Mm. And I was talking to the girls again in the office about you yesterday, and there was this general consensus that, you know, part of your aesthetic that you sort of pioneered back in the late 90s, early 2000s really feels like it could have been almost a precursor to what we now call the wellness movement, in terms of that crisp, clean aesthetic and a focus on, you know, really fresh ingredients and sort of lightness and freshness in food. So what are your thoughts, I guess, on the wellness trend, as it were? And do you think there's some truth in that sort of connection between what you were doing 20 years ago and where we're at now with wellness?
Oh, wow. I hadn't looked at it. I guess it's always been my style of recipe writing, is that I love fresh produce and I just love those flavors together. And if you're going to write a recipe to convince someone to cook on Tuesday night, it's always a couple of really fresh ingredients combined simply that's going to get them across the line. So it's kind of always been my thing of how I've approached a recipe. But I think as time goes on, you realize, just from not just your personal learnings, but also reading and investigating as one does, that we will get to a time when we will understand that food is our medicine. It's kind of, you can't avoid that kind of, as we think it's a trend. I don't think it is. I think it's just the start of where we're going to end up.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a big believer in life in balance, so I'm not going to cut anything out, and I sort of don't avoid anything, but I definitely think that food plays a huge part of in how we feel and how our body functions. And everyone wants to live longer, look better, feel better, have more energy.
Yeah. So for you, wellness isn't so much a trend, but more sort of coming into a new consciousness about how we eat and how it affects us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the future.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you as well, talking about the future of food, about, I guess, the challenges as well that are facing the food industry, particularly at the moment. You know, there's a lot of talk about, for instance, the idea that eating meat, which I do and most Australians do, and, you know, how that contributes massively to climate change and because of livestock farming and the environmental footprint of that. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on, I guess, the future of food and sustainability. Do you think we will see shifts in how we eat over, say, the next decade? And do you think there is a sort of mindset shift there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to change. That's glaringly obvious.
Yeah.
It's just how fast we can change to, as you said, save the planet, save ourselves. Hopefully it will change in time.
Yeah.
In enough time to reverse what we're doing.
Yeah.
I think just eating less and being a bit more mindful.
Yeah.
And being able to feed the entire planet it's a huge undertaking, but at least got to have a crack.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not, I think the real motivation behind my new book is that I wanted to show people that eating vegetables and eating less meat is not a chore, and you don't feel like you're missing out on anything.
Yeah.
It was a really tough book. Recipe writing was next level tough.
Yeah.
I didn't want someone to get to the end of their dinner and think, well, that was nice, but I think it would have been nicer with a few slices of chicken on top.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's actually interesting to think of your recipes from your point of view in that way, of making sure that you have the end eater's kind of, you know, like
there's satisfaction in mind.
Review in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So I tested out a lot of them on my teenage sons, who are very active rugby growing. As I just look at them walk through the door, they seem to grow a couple of centimeters every day. So I tested a lot of them out on them, because they are in the mindset, and also their school and their rugby coaches tell them that they need to have more protein, eat more meat, and faster, stronger, fitter. So it's hard to turn them around when that's who their mentors are and who they trust and believe in, that we're now going to sit down and have a zucchini, spinach, chia seed, almond meal.
Yeah.
Pancake for dinner that's topped with avocado edamame smash, but I don't want to bore them. The edamame are a complete protein as well, and animals might just be the middleman because they are eating plant protein.
Yeah.
So yeah, I tried not to bore them, but they're definitely coming around to the fact that we don't have to eat meat every meal to be the best at rugby.
The Donaghy brand over the years has consistently captured this uniquely Australian approach to food. And I know you did just touch on that before, but I'd love to know just a little more about what you think really defines Australian cuisine and whether you think it's changed over the time you've been working in food.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. As I said, you know, you couldn't buy Asian ingredients. We had to go to one shop at the back of Chinatown that did Thai ingredients and Vietnamese mint and things like that. I think that a food culture is created by the people of the country. So I think our larrikinness, our lack of regard for some rules and breaking rules and being who we are as Australians has really shaped our food culture, which is lovely. There's no national dish. Yeah. Even the pavlova is hotly contested. You know, we just have. So I think that sets us aside from anywhere else in the world, that we just have this unique view to food and ingredients. And
do you think we're like more obsessed with food than other cultures? I just feel like food is the biggest passion of so many Australians, and it's what unites us all, I guess. And I'm just wondering if you think that's true, or whether you think that every culture is sort of equally obsessed with food.
I see it in pockets where people truly cook at home. So there's lots of countries I visit where people don't really cook at home. They might assemble at home, but they're definitely not cooking. And so I see that in pockets where I travel, that people are more and more obsessed with ingredients and freshness and quality and origins of where their food came from, but they're true home cooks. So it doesn't happen all over the world. Definitely happens here, because we are a nation of home cooks, homeowners, and it's just part of who we are.
What is one of the greatest lessons you've learned over the past 20 years of running your own business and doing what you do?
I guess the fallback one for me is that it's always about the content, the quality of the content. If you can get your content to be the best you can make it, everything else will be okay. I guess I just kept telling myself that again and again and again for the past 20-something years, that if the content was perfect, beautiful, achievable, great recipes, they work every single time, you know where to buy the ingredients, then everything would be all right. Everything else would fall into place behind it. So I'm very much still content first.
What's one thing you haven't done yet that you would love to do?
Oh, I don't know. I'm kind of the kind of person that takes life as it comes and just takes opportunities as they fall.
So you don't really set long-term goals?
Goodness, no.
Really?
Never. No. I just like the universe to fall into place as it does. No, I'm a terrible goal setter. Yeah, a couple of years ago, an opportunity just fell in my lap to do the Sydney to Hobart, like 8 weeks out from the race, and it was amazing. It was just one of those things that if you have the ability in your personality to be able to lock into something and you have the stamina and the resolve to do 17 years of a magazine and its deadlines or the Sydney to Hobart, it's kind of a similar thing to me. If you've got that trigger in your personality where you can lock in and you've got the stamina to do so, then I think that's a real gift. And that race was amazing.
I guess as well, it's about just being open to opportunities that you didn't expect. Because I think for a lot of people, the default position is, you know, no, I couldn't do that.
Well, that is my first one. I always do that. Don't get me wrong. I didn't go, yeah, unreal, I'll do that. My first one that I said to my mate Rob, I was like, nah, I can't do that. Yeah. Thanks anyway. That sounds no. It's all, my first is always no. But then I have this thing in the back of my mind that always, the little voice always wins.
Wow, interesting. I can't believe you don't have long-term goals. Like, I just feel like you're such a powerhouse, and it's impossible to believe that you don't really set clear goals.
I find it limiting. I find it distracting.
So let's say you're doing a book. You must have to create like some sort of timelines and outcomes.
No, Virginia does. I'd stick to it. I do as I'm told. But that's a 3-4 month project. I don't know, maybe I'm frightened of long-term goals. Maybe I might not get there. Fear of failure, very driving force for most creatives.
I feel like if Donaghy has fear of failure, then that makes me feel like a fear of failure is clearly just a complete construct. Because there's no way that you would ever fail.
But I could. Oh, no, I could at any moment.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's got to be a driver. Something's got to drive you. I don't see fear of failure as being a negative. I feel that it's a driver.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't keep me up at night. It doesn't affect me that I'm scared and won't try anything new. It's just a motivator.
Yeah.
I think it's a positive motivator that you need to check all angles. Otherwise, fear of failure to me is not seeing something when you should have 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, why did I not check that there was sculptures by the sea on a Bondi at the same time or a marathon or, you know, like that's kind of my fear of failure is not checking my angles.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So what's next for Donna Hay?
Well, I've just told you I'm really rubbish at setting goals and plans, and I don't like making plans because it just seems to limit opportunities. So I'm just enjoying being creative and having the freedom to do so.
Well, you'll have to keep us posted and you have to bring a festival to Melbourne.
Actually, I know what I've got. I am headlining the chef series at the Australian Open in your town.
Oh, January.
January. It's an all-female lineup. So, yeah, doing that for a couple of nights, which will be fun for all the other girls. I keep forgetting about that because I feel like January is so far away, but it's not.
Well, we look forward to hosting you in Melbourne soon. And thank you, Donna, so much for being part of this podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Now it's time for 10 quick questions with Donna. What time do you set your alarm in the morning?
4:45.
What do you eat for breakfast?
A green juice and coffee.
What is your greatest indulgence?
Ice cream.
What's the most visited website on your computer this week?
British Vogue and a wellness website, which I can't remember the name of.
What was the last thing you bought online?
A leather dress.
What is one of your weekly rituals?
Oh, that's a rule. That sounds terrible. Try and catch up with my friends on Sunday.
Your favourite neighbourhood in Sydney?
Bondi.
How do you wind down?
Run.
It's 9 p.m. on a weeknight. What are you doing?
Probably cuddled up on my son's bed looking at what he's watching on YouTube.
And finally, if you could name just one thing, what would you say is your proudest professional achievement?
Sticking with a magazine for 17 years.
One of many. Thank you again so much, Donna. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you.
Donna's latest book is Week Light, a collection of easy meals to make you feel good. You can find out more about the book at donnahay.com.au and also, of course, look at zillions of other mouth-watering recipes and more info about Donna and her various projects. You can also follow Donna on Instagram at Donna Hay Magazine and also donna.hay. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. As I mentioned, this is the final episode for 2019, but don't worry, we'll be back in 2020 with more podcasts, and we'd really value your feedback in the meantime. You can email me at lucy@thedesignfiles.net with any ideas or suggestions. Thank you again so much for tuning in, and if you've enjoyed listening to TDF Talks this year, we'd be so grateful if you would leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and see you in 2020.